Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 497 for Wednesday, the 25th of May 2016. Extraordinarily, it is Wednesday, the 25th of May 2016. And my name is Martin Darlington. I'm joined on the line by Harry Lloyd from your nerve center of motorcycling racing in Barcelona.
Yeah, it's an absolutely lovely day outside, but there's nothing I'd rather be doing than sitting inside and talking about motorcycle racing, because we had an absolutely fantastic weekend, at least in Mugello. I don't think that either you or I have actually seen the BSB racing.
So, no, but we'll talk about it and we'll pretend.
Yeah, exactly. We'll pretend like we're experts. It turned out that the BSB racing was on Quest TV as Eurosport was showing the Giro d'Italia or something, so I think there are a fair few people who missed out on the BSB.
Oh, bugger. There you go. Yes. Excellent. We have had some new subscribers.
Yes, we have. We've had they're actually recurring subscribers. We've had Blue Bearings, Steve Hellam, Jeremy Kearney, and Neiman Bean. Thank you for your continued support. And we've also had a very generous donation from Darren Moore. Remember that if you want to donate or subscribe, you can go to motopodcast.com, and on the left-hand side of the page, there are some PayPal links. All of those donations and stuff are going to be helping in the coming shows. We'll keep what's coming up a bit of a surprise. Obviously, we do have episode 500 coming up in what looks to be 3 weeks, which is slightly worrying, but we are working behind the scenes to get one or two special little things sorted for that episode, and all those donations are very helpful in putting that into motion.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we can adapt the Proclaimers, I would walk 500 miles to, I would talk for 500 shows.
I'll leave the musical interlude to you.
Yeah, no, best not. We've had an absolute mail sack full of listener feedback, which we would have if we printed it off and then put the bits of paper into a sack. Don't. James Duet.
Just, yeah, that sounds about right.
He said, so everyone's been bemoaning the luck of Dovi this year, and it's undoubtedly he's had a fair odd lump of others' errors messing up his days, but what on earth is happening with Redding? He seems to have pulled in at almost every race so far this year. He's showing some blistering pace. So far, the bike isn't letting him show that over race distance. It's kind of sad because he's doing everything he can, but no one's paying attention because he's not finishing races. And he says, you know, Argentina, his tyre explodes and he gets a good slap on it. Then the bike cuts out when he was top independent. Something took him out in Mugello when he was in the top independent slot. We'll come on to that. Surely Pramac and Ducati haven't dumped a load of duff parts and poor mechanics into his pit. I'm sure they haven't. You know, I mean, James makes the point. He really wants him to do well. And it seems everything happened to him is out of his control.
Yeah.
And I absolutely share that. After the talk we had with him at the test at the beginning of the year, he was bouncing and we've seen that back. He'll come in from a couple of sessions and he really looks, boom, this is it. And then the bike just lets him down.
It must be very demoralizing because, you know, as James said, it's completely out of Redding's control. And, you know, especially after the year Redding had last year, and as you said, you know, how confident he was after testing, it must be even more demoralizing to have the bike then constantly failing. You know, it's not like he was down in 15th or whatever in testing. Redding, you know, up there in the top six at pretty much every test. So he was really hyped up for the season, and then sort of just have it all fall over. Because, I think Redding's only finished two races or something. In both the races he has finished, he won top independent in Austin. He was like sixth. So the pace is clearly there. But as we said, you know, just needs that consistency. But not just Ducati having one or two problems with parts and with bikes expiring this weekend. So
no, and won't we come on to that one?
Yes, certainly. We also had Pete Williams. He sent in an email. He said, love the podcast. Thank you, Pete. And then he spoke in the last episode. You started with a fun mail about Danny Pedrosa's weight problem and the fat suit that he could wear. Well, it got me to thinking, why not add weight? The rules of MotoGP state a minimum weight of 157 kilos for the machine alone. I don't see anything about a maximum weight. If the problem is getting the rear tires up to temperature, if the problems are really that big, why don't they compensate for Danny Pedrosa's lack of body weight by adding ballast? Or might that affect his legendary power-to-weight ratio advantage? Might the rear tire temperature actually not be as big a deal as we've been led to believe? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Do you know any other reports of riders adding weight? I know that when Pedrosa first stepped up into MotoGP, whenever there was a wet race, they'd add some ballast to the rear of his bike. But the problem with adding extra weight to a motorcycle, and especially a Grand Prix motorcycle, is they're very finely tuned. And adding weight anywhere that wasn't originally designed on that bike is going to upset the balance of it quite a lot. So it can change how that bike handles a fair bit. Danny Pedrosa and Marc Marquez, they have two slightly different machines. Obviously, you know, based around the same engine, but their chassis and stuff like that are slightly different. But I think for Honda to design a heavier motorcycle just for Pedrosa to potentially alleviate these rear grip issues would be quite an undertaking for them. And I think that Honda's issues this year are more than just Danny Pedrosa not being able to get his rear tire up to temperature. I mean, apart from Marc Marquez, all of those Honda guys are struggling massively to even stay upright in races, and that's not coming from just the rear tire. That's, you know, the engine issues and all that sort of stuff that we've been hearing about so much.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's always a balance. You know, there are times when less weight is an advantage, and there's times when more weight is an advantage. And if you can get the rear hooked up, being lighter gives you greater acceleration. You know, you need less. Or you're trying to propel less mass, therefore you need less force to get it down the straight. There's other times where undoubtedly it's makes life easier to be heavier. Maybe not heavier, but have longer limbs with more leverage. And we saw this with the battles between Simoncelli and Pedrosa when they were sniping each other so much. You know, and it's kind of, you know, the swings and roundabouts, and if you gain on one, you're going to lose on the other. And so, yeah, I'm not convinced that adding weight is really so. If it was a sensible idea, I think they'd have done it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure, you know, Honda have been racing motorcycles for a couple of years now. So I think they have a pretty good clue. And, you know, in the past, sure, Danny Pedrosa has had some issues with hitting up the rear tire, but he seems to have always worked around them pretty well. You know, his career statistics speak for themselves. As I said, I think that Honda's issues are a lot more than that, and that Pedrosa's personal issues in riding that motorcycle are probably quite low down on Honda's list. We also had the question of the week last week about who had won both a MotoGP or 500cc race and a World Superbike race. Raymond Roche wrote in saying Marco Lucanelli, Simon Crafer, Troy Bayliss, Max Biaggi, Nicky Hayden, John Kaczynski, Regis Laconi, Carlos Checa.
I think that was Pete Williams. That was the end of Pete's email, and I think one of his suggestions was Raymond Roche.
Oh, okay, that's my bad.
I don't think Raymond Roche ever won a GP.
No, he didn't. He didn't. We had Bengt Brankst. Friend of the show, Bengt Brankst. He wrote in. He sort of did a bit of a not really in the spirit of the rules. Nakamoto-san would not be too happy with him because he just Googled the answer, which, you know, not really any fun. But Bengt technically did get it correct. And there was an article on worldsuperbike.com from a couple of years ago that had most of them. So the full list is Mick Doohan, who won for Yamaha and World Superbike before heading to 500s. Kevin McGee, he won. Regis Laconi won a 500cc race before starting quite a successful World Superbike career. Makoto Tamada, he won three World Superbike races at Sugo before doing the same at MotoGP. Gary McCoy won in both. Troy Bayliss, he obviously won in both. Alex Barros, John Kaczynski, Marco Lucanelli, Chris Vermeulen, Pierre-Francisco Chiali, who won that 500cc race that some people call into question because almost no one was racing. Max Biaggi obviously won quite a few of each. Carlos Checa, Ben Spies, Marco Melandri, and now obviously Nicky Hayden. So that is the full list of riders who have won both.
Are you counting Nicky's single actual win recently, or are you counting all the virtual MotoPod wins that he had before that because he just finished?
Both. So Nicky's okay, quite successful. So, you know, most of that list is pretty easy to come up with. I was a bit surprised by a couple of them, especially the likes of Lucinelli and stuff like that. You know, they were definitely at the earliest days of World Superbikes, so a bit of a harder one. And then, of course, aside from that, we also had the BSB Super Bowl lap song. It's now been, what, three BSB rounds, and we still haven't had the Super Bowl qualifying format. The first two rounds, it was wet. And then at Brands Hatch Indy, it's too short a circuit, so they weren't going to do the one hot lap qualifying anyway. So far, this BSB initiative is not off to the greatest start. But Bengt Brakst, he wrote in with his song of Faithless We Come One. That was his suggestion. Then we also had Don Moose Parrish, who said he knows that all of us guys are young whippersnappers that may have no idea who Molly Hatchet is. I do actually know who Molly Hatchet was. So to put that right and to enhance my chance of winning the competition and the grand prize, absolutely nothing. Good that you...
You understand what you're fighting for here. Yeah,
exactly. Diddly squat. Here is the YouTube edition of Flirting with Disaster. Obviously, you can go look at that on YouTube yourselves if you
want.
That's
a great title for us. I mean, because on a Super Bowl lap, they are right on the edge. So Flirting with Disaster. I was certainly around and musically aware. I was in my mid-teens when Molly Hatchet were pumping out albums, the late 70s, early 80s. So I was certainly old. I'm certainly old enough, but no, I'd never heard of them. I assumed that Molly Hatchet was some kind of country and western singer and was a girl. He'd be very small with a massive guitar, and it wasn't at all. It's an American sort of rock band, by the looks of it.
Not quite a small country singer girl. No. We also had Paul Wing. He wrote in All Star by Smash Mouth. Quite an interesting choice there. Andy Pilbeam. He wrote in Bang 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 by Virgin Marys. And then Access DJ Messiah was his other song choice. So Motopod at motopodcast.com for your song choices and for any listener questions you may have, you know, questions, comments, concerns, and or criticisms. And I believe that Martin also has a bit of a question later in the show that he will pose to everyone as well. So
absolutely.
Get ready to look forward.
It's only going
to
last till the end of the show. But beautifully segueing, because music to my ears is one of those. Hopefully you heard that.
Yes.
And also, talking musical, the musical chairs continue this week, as announced last week. A day prematurely for the official announcement, but we all knew it was coming by then. Maverick Vinales has signed for Yamaha for 2017-2018. Almost immediately, Ducati announced that Andrea Dovizioso will be remaining at Ducati as Lorenzo's teammate, as mooted. I don't know how much influence Lorenzo had on that, but I'm sure if he was given the choice, he'd rather have Dovi because they've got similar styles or more similar styles. And I think Dovi's the kind of teammate who Lorenzo will expect, and probably not without due cause, will expect him to not make crazy last corner lunch. We've seen this season.
Andrea Dovizioso is basically the Italian version of Danny Pedrosa. You know, he's a great number two teammate.
Yeah, he's a blinkingly fast rider. He's an absolutely lovely bloke. I know that because I spent like 2.5 minutes once speaking to him. He's a really nice guy. I was going to take him home and meet my mother. But Andrea Iannone was shortly afterwards. It was announced he's going to Suzuki. They are not yet confirming who their second rider is going to be. But they did recently follow Alex Rins on Twitter.
Yes.
Obviously, does he say anything embarrassing?
Yes.
They only followed 35 people last time you checked. The rest are journos or sponsors. Interesting.
Yeah, and we've definitely seen that sort of Twitter movements have revealed rider movements in the past. Last year, Mark VDS, they followed Franco Morbidelli before they signed him to ride for them. The Rins situation is obviously complicated a little by Johann Zarco, who we know is in contact with Suzuki. He's going to Japan to test the Suzuki MotoGP bike during the summer break and also race the Suzuka 8-hour for Suzuki. So it definitely seems like it's going to be a bit of a toss-up between Rins and Zarco. And then obviously there's that second Monster Yamaha Tech 3 seat. So I'd assume that whichever one of those two doesn't get that Suzuki seat could easily slide into that Tech 3 seat. If not even, you know, the KTM seat, there's still one of those available alongside Bradley Smith. And then also, you know, we have some seats at Aprilia and lots of the other satellite teams, which could easily get some new riders.
I mean, considering the performance level that we think the Aprilia's at, I don't think Bradle and Bautista are actually doing themselves any harm.
No, I think both of those guys are getting towards the limitation of that bike. And doing quite respectably.
You couldn't really ask for more. Interestingly, Lynn Jarvis was interviewed separately from the main press conference, pre-Mugello, and he was asked who else was considered to replace Lorenzo. And he said, well, we pretty much looked at every rider in the paddock, except for Marc Marquez for obvious reasons. And I can only assume that it's like, you know, Rossi would walk out or he'd refuse. Or the obvious one is, come on, we know he's not going to leave HRC. He is their boy. But then someone said, did you consider Pol Espargaró for the factory seat? He said, no. in that very blunt, direct, I mean, he's brutal, isn't he, Lynn Jarvis? He is Machiavelli reborn.
Yeah, he's a hard dude.
Yeah. Have you considered? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, his results haven't been good enough. And he also commented, I can't remember if it was that interview or if it was one before that I'd seen with him, when someone asked about Alex Rins, he said, well, he's made it very clear that he wants to move straight to a factory. He said, so I don't think he'll be going to one of the top factories because his results haven't been good enough to warrant that. So that'd be a huge risk to bring someone up. And you could hear a voice in the background going, you did it with Lorenzo. And
yeah, he said, Lorenzo is also a double world champion or triple world.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, 2 years and 250s, two championships. And just stared the guy down, didn't say anymore. And it was like, okay. Yeah. And when you look at it, you know, Marquez didn't win both his Moto 2 years, but, you know, this first year is because he bounced himself up the road on his head. Mm. And you, do you remember that with the eye injury? And he said his eyes.
There was a legitimate chance he could have gone permanently blind. And even in pre-season testing, he was still having vision problems when he was in a racing tuck. I mean, that injury could have easily been career ending. And he was only, 17, 18 at the time?
Yeah, I mean, that we nearly saw the last of it. But Pol Espargaró, it's starting to look like he's going to be shunted out and Tech2R will have a... I mean, we know they've got Jonas Folger coming in. I mean, I don't think they've confirmed yet that Pol is not being re-signed, but pretty much the same as Bradley. Okay, he's a couple of years younger than Bradley. But Bradley said, you know, I'm leaving Tech2R, not renewing my contract. They've made it very clear to me, but in a very nice way, because they're here to bring up young, fast riders. And at 27, I'm no longer considered young and or fast, delete where applicable sort of thing. So, you know, Pol has been very inconsistent. He's having a better season this season, but he's been very inconsistent.
Mm. He's also been very vocal about how he doesn't appreciate how Yamaha have been treating him.
Yeah. What, you mean getting all the best stuff first last year and then still having Bradley handing your ass to you? But I don't think Alex Rins is putting in the performances that warrant demanding straight to factory.
No, I mean, we'll talk about Moto2 in a bit, but Alex Rins certainly hasn't really had the consistency or the sort of wow factor that Marc Marquez or Maverick Vinales had in the class.
Okay, right. Question time. Just for the duration of the show, just for fun, you can go and Google it or exhaustively go through MotoGP.com's records, which is what I had to do to find this out, because I've got to be honest, I couldn't remember. Who was the last non-alien to win a MotoGP race? Can you remember who it was and when it was, and if you're really clever, where it was? And when I say alien, that's Rossi, Lorenzo, Pedrosa, Marquez at the moment, and obviously before Marquez we had Stoner. Mm. So none of those five, although we've only have had four at a time, Stoner having retired the season before Marquez arrived. Mm. And we'll give you the answer at the end of the show, but it shocked me how long ago it was.
Yeah, it's been a fair while. And the race that was won was also some slightly odd circumstances as well.
Yes, yes. We won't go into any further than that because we'll give you too many clues. And speaking of one of the aliens, the ex-alien, Casey Stoner, he was shown a lot on BT Sport, BT Sport's coverage, looking very thoughtful in the Ducati pit, really seemed to be studying, you know, the lap times, the data. I mean, gee, he's taking this testing job really seriously.
Yeah, he's not just in it for a bit of extra cash. He's, you know, he really wants to be there. And he said that the reason for his trip to Mugello was so that he could see the bike out on track and he could talk with all the riders to understand what their feelings are.
Yeah, absolutely. He was interviewed by Neil Hodgson and Gavin Emmett. Very good. He was very forthright. And he said, you know, they said, you're good friends with Lorenzo now. And he went, absolutely. Really, really good friends. Got huge respect for him. He said, you know, we had our issues when we were both racing together, but I'm really, really looking forward to him coming on board with our team. And, you know, he seemed to have completely got back into that thing of, yeah, Ducati, we're one big family. We all work together for everybody's benefit. Julian Ryder is adamant that he'll wildcard at the Austrian round, which to me, I thought, the first time he said it, I thought, did he say Austrian or Australian? Surely Phillip Island is the obvious one. And then he said, no, Red Bull Ring, Austria. And I'm thinking, okay, don't know why he's adamant, and it is probably worth remembering that a week ago he was adamant that Danilo Petrucci would get the second Ducati factory, which hasn't worked out. So, you know,
yeah.
Mr. Wright is enormously experienced and venerated grandfather of the paddock on the journalist side, but even he gets things wrong every now and again.
Yeah, I mean, Austria would make sense in the fact that every rider is going there with zero experience. So it's not like Casey Stoner would be playing catch up, you know, not having ridden there last year. But it does seem a bit of a strange one, unless maybe Stoner still has his Red Bull sponsorship. So maybe they're encouraging Stoner to ride there because it's a Red Bull sponsored event, maybe?
Certainly possible. I suppose the fact it's going to be new for everybody. So it's a level playing. He might have said that. He might have said, look, you know, mind you, it's not like he doesn't know Phillip Island or anywhere else, for that matter.
I think that Ducati and several other people would probably be against Casey Stoner riding at Phillip Island because to have a guy... because he'll win and he'll make every other rider out there look, especially the Ducati riders, look like they've had their pants pulled down and their bottom slapped because, you know, he hasn't raced since whenever it was, 2012. And then
I did wonder where that sentence was going there. They've had their pants down and their bottoms, I thought you were going to say penetrated.
No, just slapped. But, you know, it depends how much he wins by. But moving swiftly along, before we continue down that dark alleyway, Padgetts have announced that they will be running the Honda MotoGP road bike, the RC213VS, at the Isle of Man TT this year with Bruce Anstey in both the Superbike and Senior TT races. TT allows basically an organizer's discretion to what bikes you can enter. So as long as the organizer says it's okay, you can enter whatever you like. And that means, you know, that's also why we have the Suter 500cc two-stroke running at this year's Isle of Man. But
both of those are going to be really interesting to watch.
Yes, especially that RC213VS. It's derived from MotoGP technology. And since the launch, I haven't really heard anything about the bike. I've never heard it do a track day. I've never heard it raced anywhere. So this will be the first time that we've seen anyone other than a journalist or Ron Haslam, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it might have been the year Jim went to the TT or one of our listeners, or I might have heard it on a different podcast. Oh, my God, I listened to them. I need to steal their information and pretend it's ours. But someone was saying, you know, how would a MotoGP bike get on here? And I think it was to someone like McGuinness or Martin. They went, it was a Northerner anyway, because he went, it would get absolutely stuffed. And I said, no, it's too knife-edged. It needs very, very particular conditions. And you can adapt it to different conditions, but not on the same track. You know, it needs consistency around that track. And I said, and at the TT, you've got so many varying. You know, they were saying our bikes are much closer to a road bike than to a MotoGP bike.
Mm.
I'm not sure quite how true that is, certainly in terms of cost. But yeah, it would be interesting to see how it goes. Can they soften it enough to be able to absorb the incredible variation of road condition that you meet on a 38-mile lap of the island?
Yeah, that's my big question. Is I think that the bike is either going to fly and set a new lap record that's going to last for like the next 20 years or something. Mm-hmm. Or it's going to be way too difficult to handle and Bruce is going to have a terrible TT because he's trying to tame this beast which is made for a short circuit. And, you know, as we've seen with road racers riding on short circuits and with some short circuit riders riding at the TT, is that with riders, sometimes, you know, that knowledge doesn't cross over and it could very well be the same with bikes.
Yeah.
Cameron Donald, a fair few years ago, when he was riding for Rizla Suzuki at the TT, he got a chance to do a parade lap on the Rizla Suzuki MotoGP machine. And he said that, you know, he gave that bike a bit of a push. But other than that, I'm not too sure how it's going to go. I don't think, and this is very much a Padgett's effort. I don't think Honda have any involvement in it at all other than selling the bike to Padgett's. So I'm not sure how much data there is. I'm not sure if the MotoGP data will be of any help because, you know, Mugello certainly isn't, certainly isn't the TT, as you quite rightly said.
No, I think it's going to be... Well, it's going to be fascinating. It is going to be fascinating. Absolutely no doubt about it. But, where that one goes will be worth watching.
Yes, definitely. And it will be certainly be nice to watch. Bruce Anstey continues to be the luckiest man at the TT because he also got to ride the 500cc Yamaha Grand Prix bike at the Classic TT. So Bruce is quite the lucky boy.
Now, some good, very interesting news. Sylvain Guintoli is not going to be fit for Donington Park. So the factory World Superbike Yamaha is going to have a replacement rider in the form of Cameron Beaubier.
Yes.
Who is one of the two, or two of the, one of the leading riders in Moto America at the moment, which brings us back to the discussion we had. And I've just been trying to dig out Steve from Texas, who questioned me on my, what he thought I was making disparaging remarks about Moto America. And I was just asking the question, what level is it at? Well, this will give us, it's only one person, an unfamiliar track. And if it rains, which it probably will, because it's England in the summer, you know, it's only a snapshot, but it will give us an idea. If Cameron Beaubier comes and he's, you know, God, if he's top five, that really shows that this kid can ride. You know,
that would be better than most of Lowe's and Guintoli's results as well, if he manages to get it in the top five.
Yeah. No, actually, that's true. And that's probably unrealistic. I mean, top 10 would be really, really good. But not only would it give him a bit of a step in, it would also make people go, okay, well, the guys across there who are around his level, that implies that they're also, you know, at a level where we might consider them. So, yeah, it'd be really interesting to see, and I'm chuffed they've done it. That's good.
Ben Spies is Cameron Beaubier's mentor, and Ben Spies had written an article, I think it was for Cycle World a couple of weeks ago, it was a multiple-part article where Ben Spies had sort of talked about all of the challenges of going over from America to Europe. You know, not only the track's different, but American suspension is set up very differently to European suspension. So, you know, it's a lot
Well,
more
they like
than...
it nice and soft, yeah. So when they have their double cheeseburger... Sorry, no, stop!
We almost got a whole show without a cheese mention. But yeah, so Ben Spies was just talking about all the differences between an AMA spec bike and a World Superbike bike. So, you know, it's a bit more than just learning the track. You know, there's certainly a lot of new things to learn on that bike, even though he has been riding it in Moto America. But I hope that Cameron Beaubier can do well. He's definitely, you know, one of the upcoming stars of the Moto America series. And it seems like every year people are sort of curious if he'll make a step over to either Moto 2 or World Superbike. And hopefully Ben Spies is there, because maybe he'll commentate, and Ben Spies is quite good at race commentary, and I have quite a soft spot for Ben Spies.
So. Yeah, he's such a laid-back dude, isn't he? But he's very incisive. Yeah. So, Mugello.
Yeah, what a weekend. My, oh my, Mugello is a bit of a good racetrack, isn't it?
Oh, it's just fantastic, and I'm still so praying that Circuit of Wales actually happens. It looked off, and then now it looks on again, because it is built across a valley in a very similar kind of, you know, vertical displacement of Mugello, and that's kind of the closest model they've looked at. You know, it's just brilliant. It's got fast sweeping corners. It's got, you know, the downhill. We all know what it's like. Anyone who's ridden bikes, you know, downhill corners are horrible, because you've got all that inertia pushing you on. You know, plus gravity, and I mean, some of the corners on there, and you that and that straight. And the point being made on the MotoGP bikes is they're going light up the gentle little hump just at the point you want to put your brakes on.
Yeah,
which is really. And the Moto3 had no such trouble, and we'll start with those. But I mean, even the QP, even the qualifying session was incredible. We had real changes right up to the end.
Yeah, there were also some funny antics. Brad Binder, he went through the pit lane to try and get some clear track, and then had about 7 riders follow him through into pit lane. Obviously, the slipstream in Mugello is worth quite a lot. You know, it can be worth upwards of a second just down the straight alone. So getting in a slipstream can be quite an advantage, but it's a bit of a joke to see world championship riders following another rider through the pit lane to try and get a toe.
Yes. Slightly sad. But again, we had the I'm following my mentor, Valentino Rossi, in being crap at qualifying, Romano Fanati, deciding, nope, I'm going to get on pole, which he did by nearly a third of a second. I mean, that was pretty impressive. From Andrea Mignot, who is teammate, and there was some really good teamwork going on there.
Yeah, definitely. The Sky VR46 team, at least Fanati and Mignot, they get on quite well. I think Fanardi likes Migno because Migno's never really had any great results. But there was a lot of formation flying, not only from them, but also from the Red Bull IO team. Brad Binder was also helping out his brother Darren a bit with a bit of a slipstream on occasion. But, you know, we've come to see that in Moto2, in Moto3. As is now commonplace in Moto3, further down the pack, there were also a number of grid penalties for riders going slow. But most of those riders were qualifying quite low down anyway, so no big upsets for them. But surprisingly, Kyrill Inampawi managed to also get it on the front row. He was strong pretty much the entire weekend. You know, after his win in Argentina, he hadn't really done anything, but it seems like that this fast and flowing circuit was suiting him a bit more. His teammate Hiroki Ono, he would eventually qualify 11th, but Ono had been up there in several sessions as well. Brad Binder headed the second row, ahead of title rival Jorge Navarro, with Ennea Bastianini securing sixth with his still healing recently broken right wrist. So really commendable effort there from Ennea Bastianini to end ahead of Nicolò Belega, Francesco Bagnaia, Aaron Canet, and Juan Mir in 10th. So pretty good result. A number of rookies, as we can see, 7th, 9th, and 10th, all former championship contenders in last year's CEV FIM Repsol Junior World Championship. We'll be back this weekend in Aragon, so be sure to watch that. There's my little plug done for the week. But yeah, qualifying was quite good, but it really didn't hold the candle to what was one of the most bonkers Moto3 races we've had. And we've had some pretty bonkers Moto3 races.
And I haven't seen it, so you run with this one. I saw the qualifying. I've not yet got to see the race.
Well, Martin, you should stop this show and go watch it now because it was absolutely insane. We went off the line and the usual suspects are ahead, but they couldn't break away. And for the entire race, we had a pack of about 20 riders who were constantly together. The run into San Donato, easily 5 abreast, if not 6 abreast. You know, riders could quickly find themselves going from 1st to 5th with the slipstream.
Yeah.
Brad Binder, the championship leader, he was getting battered around. He'd be 1st one lap. He was down as low as 8th at 1. 8th at 1 point.
So was Fanati.
Yeah, and it was just incredible to see all the riders just get pushed around. We had some unusual names up the front. We had Lorenzo Della Porta, who was riding as a replacement for Philip Oertel with the Scheld GP Racing Team. He was leading at several points. We had Fabio Quartararo come back from outside the top 15, and he was leading for multiple laps. We also had Fabio De Gian Antonio, who I hoped would have never led a race because his name is incredibly difficult to say, and I've had to practice it all fucking weekend. but there you go. He also did very, very well. And, you know, the unfortunate thing about the lap chart is that it only shows who was leading when they crossed the line. Because before they crossed the line, there were about 50 changes a lap, not only for the lead, but throughout the pack. It was just absolutely incredible to see. Unfortunately, with so many riders that close together, there were some DNFs. The first notable DNF was Romano Fanardi. He actually didn't get involved with any other riders. But while he was fighting for the lead, his chain broke. So he had to roll off to the side of the circuit. Huge disappointment for Fanardi. He was looking really strong. You know, we know Fanardi can fight in races. So huge disappointment for him. And then obviously a huge blow to his championship, not being able to score any points.
Yeah.
Fanardi's departure was followed quite soon after by Jorge Navarro, yet again another championship contender. Juan Fanguevara on the RBA Racing Team bike, he got up the inside of Jorge Navarro at the final corner. There was a touch and Navarro got sent flying. Navarro was luckily unharmed, but again, main championship rival, not taking any points, pretty good for Brad Binder. We had quite a big crash from Kyrill Inampawi on the last lap or second last lap. And then Aaron Canet, he had one of the most spectacular crashes of the day, coming around the last corner in a pretty similar place to his teammate Jorge Navarro. Canet got flung off the bike, but in true racer style, even though he was upside down, basically looking down at the bike, his wrist was still twisting the throttle. So he did not want to let go of that bike and pretty much held the throttle open until they both hit the gravel. His race was obviously, unfortunately, over after that. But, you know, in true Moto3 at Mugello style, it did all come down to the last lap and that slipstream. Brad Binder did an incredible job to work his way up from, I think he was 8th as that lap began, to lead the race. He opened up about a quarter of a second gap, which would be just enough to avoid the slipstream. But, you know, all of the top 5 were within a 10th of a second of each other at the line.
Yeah,
and it was only really in that lap that they were able to break away. For most of the race, the top 20 were within 2 seconds of each other, which is basically, you know, all those bikes back to front, back to front, back to front.
Nose to tail.
2 seconds.
Yeah.
Really incredible. So Binder did just enough to break the slipstream. It looked like Fabio Quartararo and Nicola Antonelli were then going to take second and third. But then out of nowhere, there comes Fabio Di Giannantonio and Francesco Bagnaia on the Mahindra, interestingly enough, to steal second and third. So Brad Binder would take victory. Fabio Di Giannantonio, whose best result before this was 17th, scored not only his first championship points, but his first championship podium with second place at his home crowd. And then a great job from Bagnaia showing that that Mahindra can do some work. Lots of the other Mahindras were still struggling from gearbox issues. So I'm wondering if maybe Bagnaia has a slightly different gearbox to the rest of the Mahindras, because he seems to be the only one who can really be competitive throughout all of the races. But it was an incredible finish to the race. And you should certainly go back and watch the Moto3 race, because it was absolutely insane. And, you know, Lorenzo Della Porta, who, as I said, was leading at various points, he eventually ended up in 15th place, which is just testament to how much everyone was getting buffed.
And what the stat I love from that was the win. Brent Binder won by 38 thousandths of a second, 0.038 of a second. That was the largest winning margin of the weekend. You're like, what?
Yeah.
That's just fantastic. Yeah, so on the standings, I mean, Brad Binder is 1 point short of 2 race wins clear of Jorge Navarro.
Yep.
And Brad Binder, 127, 49 points behind his Jorge Navarro, a further 11 points behind his Romano Fenati, a further 12 points behind him is Nicolò Belega. I mean, wow. Brad Binder's doing a Danny Kent.
Yeah, exactly. Brad Binder actually has 3 more points than Danny Kent had at this same stage of the championship last year. So very much in the same way as Danny Kent last year. It's very much Brad Binder's championship to lose. On Friday in Mugello, Binder said that he wants to win every single race remaining in the year. And after taking 3 back-to-back wins in 3 very different races, I think that Binder could do it. Obviously, Moto3 is a bit tricky because, you know, things like slipstream can play such a crucial role. But I can't
It's hardly earth-shattering, though, is it, for a racer who is being very successful to say, I'd like to win every race. But like, really? Wow. I didn't expect you to say that. I thought you'd probably hope to get maybe a couple of fourths or fifths because you don't like champagne. What a daft thing to, you know, it's like, well, duh. That's why you're out there. I'm quite sure that Livio Loi would like to win every race.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I see the point you're taking. And of course, having the lead he has, as we saw with Danny Kent last year, it brings its own pressures.
Yeah, exactly. So that will be the interesting thing, is to see how Binder does handle it. Obviously, we saw Danny Kent fold under the pressure. I mean, I don't think that anyone would try and argue differently. Danny Kent in those last couple of races did very much bottle it and, you know, was finishing 7th when he should have been finishing 1st. But yeah, you know, it's looking great for Binder.
And yet, I can't help remembering Aragon, where he was nailed on for 3rd and he went for 2nd high-sided, where actually it was totally unnecessary because his main rival for the championship had just fallen off behind him.
Yeah.
Now, his main rival actually became Miguel Oliveira, and it wasn't at the time. I'm trying to think who it was.
Andrea Bastianini.
Bastianini had crashed out behind him. He may not have been aware of that, but, you know, but yeah, towards the end, it was very reminiscent, I felt, of James Toseland, another Brit, obviously, in the 2007, the 2nd World Superbike Championship. And it was like, you're kind of just doing enough here. And it's a shame when that happens. Anyway, we went on to Moto2 and the qualifying. Flipping X, AMLOS is looking on it.
Yes, but so is the rest of the field, because the top 15 in Moto2 qualifying were separated by just half a second. To put that into perspective, the top 4 in Moto3 was separated by 0.3 of a second, with Jorge Navarro 0.6 of a second back on Fenati's pole time. So
Moto2
is ridiculously close, at least in qualifying.
I got back from work and I had to, we're nursing another stray cat we found that was dying and now isn't. In fact, I'm surprised he's in here with me. I'm surprised we haven't heard him because he's quite vocal. But I had to go to the vets, and I got back thinking, well, at least I'm back in time for MotoGP. Turn the telly on and they said, and we're coming to the grid, ready to start Moto2. And I thought, what on earth has happened here? You know, I leave work an hour early without noticing and without anyone else noticing? And of course, no, it wasn't. So I saw the second race, the 10-lap sprint, what on earth happened?
So in the first race, they got 3 laps through, and then Xavier Vierge, he crashed at the Biondetti chicane, and his bike took out an air fence. So they had to stop the race to reinflate the air fence. And of course, because it's Italy, that took a long, long time, because that's just how Italians do. And yep. Then they tried to use the quick restart procedure for the first time of the season. And then about half of the field got penalized for not leaving pit lane soon enough. So then Erta were trying to take riders off the grid, but then there were too many riders, so it was unsafe. So then they called off that restart, and then they restarted the restart. And that whole process took, I don't know how long, about an hour probably. And it was a bit of a mess, to be honest. It seems like there was a bit of a breakdown in communication between one or two of the teams and Erta. You know, I'm sure that the teams will now go back and have a bit of a look through the rule book. Because as we said, this was the first time that they were using the new rules. So when the racing did eventually get underway, it was only 10 laps, which I think that every Moto2 race from now on should only be 10 laps, because it was probably the best Moto2 race in about 2 or 3 years.
It was fantastic, wasn't it? I mean, they were making the point as it started. Sam Lowes had gone for hard tyres where most were on mediums, and obviously with the expectation of a 21-lap race, not a 10-lap race, and it did look like Sam was going to suffer from that. And they said, well, you know, I think he'd used all his mediums or... Anyway, whatever he was left.
The issue was that Sam hadn't really felt comfortable on the medium tyres. He set his pole lap with the hard tyre, so it seemed like that tyre was definitely right. Working for him over the weekend.
But, I mean, Lorenzo Baldessari was absolutely on it. And it's a great-looking bike, that Ford team bike. I like the colours of it. You know, it's a number 7, which obviously for people of my generation brings back memories of you know, Barry Sheen. And it's just a great number 7, isn't it? And he was absolutely on it.
He was either going to crash or win.
Yeah. Which, in fact, and he did neither, of course. But Johann Zarco was he'd had a subdued weekend up to that point, hadn't he? I mean, he wasn't, nothing quite seemed to be working. He qualified, was it ninth? He qualified sixth.
He was really off the boil, as was Alex Rins. Yeah. It seemed like Lowes had this big opportunity to take back a huge amount of points. And in the first race, Zarco was actually way down the field. You know, his first race start didn't get off to a good one at all. And it was actually quite fortunate for Zarco that the race got red flags, that he was able to go back into the box and make one or two tweaks, and also change those soft tyres, as we said.
But, I mean, Rins had started the second race. He finished the first lap in 19th position.
Yeah, that's because Rins was one of the guys who'd been penalised for not leaving the lane soon enough. So him, Edgar Pons, who else was it? Simone Corsi, lots of those guys, they'd start the race from the back of the grid. So Rins's ride wasn't too bad considering, but...
No, but he started 19th. It was only... Laps 2 and 3, between at the end of lap 2, he was so it was only the third lap that he didn't overtake anybody by the end of the lap and make up a place, because he made his way up to 7th, which was pretty impressive. But the thing that got me at the front was Tom Luthi looked, he's on it, and he took over from Baldessari. Then he got taken, I think he ran wide, didn't he, and Baldessari and Zarco came past him. And it was really, and Hafiz Siren was also up there. And then Sam Lowes got past Siren and tucked onto the back of Luthi, and he's thinking, I'm not sure you're going to be able to get past it. And then he did, and managed to make it stick. And I do think Tom Luthi's probably the most pissed off person amongst them all, because he'd looked pretty much like he was going to be on the podium this weekend,
I don't know. Tom Luthi's issue has always been his aggression. He's never been aggressive enough of a rider. He's one of those guys who, when he gets passed, sometimes he'll pass back and sometimes he won't. And I think that was sort of evident here, that, you know, it seemed like once Lowes got passed, it didn't really seem like Luthi was, you know, chomping at the bit to get back at him. I don't know. That's just how I saw it, at least.
No, fair enough. Very few fallers. We had 3 didn't start. Xavier Simeon, Luca Marini and Xavi Vierge. Didn't start.
Simeon crashed on the formation lap of the race restart. Luca Marini and Alex Marquez, they crashed together in the first part of the race. Alex Marquez was able to remount and ride his bike back into the pits. So he was able to restart. And then obviously since Vierge caused the red flag, he wasn't allowed to restart either.
No, but during the 10-lap sprint, we lost Luis Salom and Matty Bassini, but that was it. So we had Zarco came through and won. Lorenzo Baldassarre was second. Sam Lowe's held on to third place to join them on the podium with Luthi Siren. Axel Pons, a comfortable three and a half seconds ahead of Alex Rins, sixth and seventh respectively. Franco Morbidelli, eighth. Taki Nakagami and Dominic Agon, ninth and tenth. The Cortese, Corsi, Oliveira, Kent and Folger rounding out the points, and the unfortunate Alex Marquez came in just outside the points.
At least he finished a race, but you know he did also crash the race before, so you know a bit of a mixed weekend for Alex Marquez. The other thing that really stands out about Moto 2 is just how bad Jonas Folger's season has gone since signing that Monster Yamaha Tech 3 contract. He obviously crashed in France in the race and had I think four other crashes throughout the weekend, and then in the first race Folger had to come into the pits because he had a quick shifter problem, and then in the second race he could only finish 15th. Even though before that, Folger had been challenging for race wins and podiums pretty consistently. So
I think it's because he's got a boring paint job.
You think? It's not that bad.
That black and red, so it's just a bit dull.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite Baldassarre's custom livery for the Italian GP. That, as you said, that white, red, and green was pretty nice. And as we said, the battle between Zarco and Baldassarre was incredible. Because it was only 10 laps, every rider was just giving it everything they had, not having to worry about tyre life, and that made for a pretty special race.
There was a lot of backing in.
Yes, definitely. And also and a lot of touching between Zarco and Baldassarre. Those two boys were definitely getting their elbows out, and it was great to see.
And then the standings, it's the tightest of all the three series by far. 98, Sam Lowe's, 96, Alex Rins. Tom Luthi, 82. And it's interesting what you said about him. It's strange. I don't look at Tom Luthi as a title contender, really. You look at him, you think, okay, he's there. It's a bit like, I hate to damn someone with faint praise, a bit like Dovi. He'll be up there in the point, or Danny Pedrosa, you know, except for the one or two odd seasons in his, 38 years and the running for HRC, whatever it is. Zarco's a point behind Luthi, but you just know Zarco's going to finish the season ahead of him.
Yeah,
above it.
Luchi's that guy who's there to make the most of other people's mistakes. Is that, you know, you can very easily see Lowe's, Rins, or Zarco crashing out of a race. And it's in those races where Luthi's just going to, you know, keep puttering along and, you know, get a pretty good result. And that's sort of what's kept Luthi inside the top four, is that obviously he took that win in Qatar, which was a very good win for Luthi. And since then, he's been pretty consistently inside the top 10, but he's had a lot of races where he hasn't really been in the podium hunt. That he's just really, really consistent, like a Swiss watch.
Very nice. And we've the other thing to look at as well is the chassis manufacturer. In the top 17, it's all Kalexes apart from Corsi and Simeon speed-ups. That's it.
Yep.
No shooters, no Tech Trois. And the 17th place, and only stretched it down to 17, was Danny Kent on 12 for our British listeners. 3 points behind his teammate Miguel Oliveira, and neither of them really having a very easy time of it.
Both of them are struggling. You know, that Leopard Racing team, as we've said, struggling a bit in Moto 2 and not having the best Moto 3 season either. Fabio Quartararo was up there challenging for the race win this weekend, but I don't know, maybe resources are stretched a bit too thin, just not quite gelling.
No. And then we got to the big boys, MotoGP. Qualifying on Saturday, FP3 was really, really entertaining because it just kept changing. Someone would go in, you think, he's third, fifth, seventh, he's eighth, he's ninth, now he's tenth. Oh, he's in the danger spot. No, he's 11th, he's 13th. Damn. No, he's back up to sixth, ninth, tenth. You know, it was incredible, the changes. And, you know, lots of people were saying, wow, this is going to be one of the most difficult or the most challenging Q1s we've had for a long time, because we had a lot of people you would expect to go straight through to Q2. And going through them, you think, Scott Redding, yeah, when Scott's on it, he's definitely a Q2 qualifier. Alex Espargaro, definitely. Dovi, of course. Paul Espargaro, yes. Hector Barber's been up there a lot. Cal Crutchlow should be up there. And then you get the normal Q2 guys, Q1 guys, Jack Miller, Eugene Laverty, Alvaro Bautista, Stefan Bradl, Loris Baz, Tito Rabat, didn't take part because unfortunately Tito had crashed in FP and has broken his collarbone.
Yes, crashed at the same place where Rossi broke his leg all those years ago. It'll be interesting to see how Rabat comes back from this. Rabat's obviously had a pretty tough season, and I can't imagine that a broken collarbone has really helped his mental strength.
No, and BT Sport, Ryder or Hewan are one of them making the point that he's supposedly quite openly very, very unhappy in the MotoGP paddock and wants to change to something. Whether he goes back to Moto2 or he goes across to Superbikes, who knows. But yeah, not a happy chappy. But we had in Q1... Oh yeah, that was the point I was making. This is what led me to look for this who was the last non-alien to win a race question.
Mm.
Is that people saying, oh, it's such a strong Q1. Well, between all of those riders, they've got one GP win, which was Dovi at Donington. I was there in the wet many years ago. By the way, the soundtrack you can hear in the background, that's Frankie. He's got blue eyes, so obviously I call him Frankie. The older listeners will understand the reference.
Over my head.
Yeah, you might have heard your father talk about someone called Frank Sinatra in the past.
Oh, Frank Sinatra. Yeah. I know him.
Yeah. Old blue eyes, hence Frankie.
Okay.
But, right. Anyway, so we had Scott Redding and Aleix Espargaró went through, but it wasn't as simple as that because, I mean, it was so flipping close.
Yeah.
It really was. It was great. Then we went out for Q2, and it was like, okay, well, Lorenzo's going to go out, nail it, and then Marquez might beat him, and then Lorenzo could come back and nail it. It didn't happen at all. We had Ian Oni at the top for a while. We had Vinales at the top. And Lorenzo Marquez. Lorenzo never really set the sort of time that most people would expect.
No, all weekend, Lorenzo never really seemed as strong as I and a lot of other people thought he would be. You know, it was Ian Oni leading most of the sessions. And, you know, Lorenzo was up there in the times, but never really challenging for the top spot too much.
No. He was saying, you know, we're having a few problems getting the rear to hook up and this, that, you know. But then Rossi just went on one of those laps that he suddenly seems able to do far more regularly these days than he did in his dominant years of championships. And, it was an incredible lap. Less than 1/100th of a second he beat Vinales by.
But...
leading to... Lorenzo accusing them of working together because there was a bit of following going on.
Yes, there was. They were sort of swapping positions, and we've seen them. We've seen Rossi and Vinales follow each other and give each other a bit of a toe in qualifying at almost every race this year. So maybe they're practicing for when they're teammates. I'm not sure how much the slipstream actually helped both of the riders on their laps. Jorge Lorenzo was quite upset about it because, of course, he was. Rossi then made some reply about, you know, it's like copying at school, you know, what are they going to do, send a note to my mum? But yeah, I don't know if it did have any impact, but it certainly gave people something to talk about.
Yeah, it did, and a lot of the comments were, Rossi will be helping Vinales right up to the point that Vinales starts beating Rossi. I think I've probably mentioned before that I've got a bet with a friend at home who's he's not a blinkered Rossi fan. He's a MotoGP fan. But Pete Jones, Pete, if you're listening, hello. Yakidar. He's and it's for if I win, I get wine gums. And if he wins, he gets jelly babies. I've said Vinales will finish the season ahead of Rossi.
What, so, this season or next season?
No, next season.
Okay,
next
I was going to say this season.
No. This is a long-term bet. Oh, no. I don't think Vinales will pip in this season, but next season I think he will.
Maybe.
And then it's interesting, again, you look at the lap chart, doesn't look like much of a race. It was a hell of a race.
Well, but before we even got to the race, there was a bit of drama, because in morning warm-up, Jorge Lorenzo had an engine blow, which is something quite unusual. You know, the last engine blow-up that I can remember before Lorenzo's was Ben Spee's in Indianapolis in what it must have been 2011 or 2012, maybe.
No, and Lorenzo had one let go. Was it at COTA or Aragon in a practice? Mm-hmm. And yeah, only 2 or 3 years ago. I remember Lorette, and it was, and they were saying, "Oh, will he have enough to get to the end of the season?" It was when the really strict and reduced. It might have been the CRT year. It might have been the open bike year. I can't remember.
Okay. Well, anyway, obviously, yeah. as Martin said, there are now engine restrictions, so they only have 7 engines for a year. This was Jorge Lorenzo's 3rd engine of the year. The other 2 are still in rotation, but this 3rd engine had done less miles than either 2 of those engines. So it was quite peculiar for it to blow up in such a spectacular fashion. Yamaha fitted a new engine to Lorenzo's bike for the race, so he definitely went in with fingers crossed that nothing else would happen.
Well, David Emmett on MotorMatters.com made a very good point about why would you see this. He said, Tony Goldsmith, who's a very, very accomplished photographer, had posted a couple of pictures, which David's put a link to.
I'll include them in the show notes for anyone interested as well.
Yeah, they're fantastic. But they do show that going down that straight at Mugello, the rear wheel, as well as the front wheel, will come off the ground. And there is nothing to stop that wheel, because you've got your throttle pinned to hit your 220 mile an hour in Ian Oney's case, you know, that rear wheel is just going to, you're going to hit your rev limiter.
Yeah.
And that is not something that happens at many tracks with these bikes, not with the MotoGP bikes. The Moto3s maybe, but, you know, the MotoGP bikes. And it, so he said, he was saying it puts a unique strain on the engines. Having said that, still quite worrying.
Yes. Absolutely,
certainly still quite worrying.
Yeah, so the race got off to a dramatic start. Obviously, the run down to San Donato is always impressive. Jorge Lorenzo made a killer start to come back his fifth place on the grid, and he led down into San Donato right beside Valentino Rossi. Meanwhile, Maverick Vinales and Andrea Iannone got perhaps the worst start of their lives and dropped down into eighth for Iannone and for Maverick Vinales.
Yeah, Ian only had a clutch problem, didn't he? And he said it just didn't hook up. Vinales said it was fine until he went into fourth gear, and then it was almost like they'd hit the pit lane limiter, which he'd already be way over the 60 kilometers an hour for the pit lane limiter in fourth gear. But he said everyone just went past me, and he's back to 11th. So, and it was a shame for him because he was, towards the end of the race, he was holding the same lap times as the leaders.
Yeah, but both he and Iannone made a really good recovery in the race, but it was really that first 2-3 laps that absolutely ruined their chances of fighting for victory or the podium, in Vinales' case.
But, I mean, Iannone, hats off to him. You know, he's just signed for Suzuki, having been basically dumped by Ducati, and he kind of went about showing them that they'd made a mistake. I mean, he ended up back down in 11th at the end of the second lap. Vinales had gone past him, so he fought his way up. Dovi looked really strong, then sort of curiously faded, and then came back again. I don't really know what was going on with Dovi.
Well, throughout the weekend, Dovi had an issue with his neck. It was from some injury he had in like 2005 or something. So the left side of Dovizioso's neck was hurting and restricting his movement a lot. Interestingly, Andrea Iannone posted a picture on Instagram making fun of it and then quite quickly deleted said photo because clearly someone at Ducati had a bit of a word to him. So Dovizioso, I'm not quite sure. Dovizioso also revealed after the race that he was suffering from a bit of arm pump in his right arm. And towards the end of the race, when Dovizioso was battling with Pedrosa and with Iannone for third, it was that arm pump that caused him to run wide at San Donato and eventually ruin his chances of the podium. But speaking of San Donato, that's where most of the action in the first part of the race happened. Jorge Lorenzo and Valentino Rossi. Rossi would come right in Lorenzo's slipstream and do everything he could to get past Lorenzo on the brakes. But somehow, Jorge Lorenzo managed to outbrake him every single time.
He did a beautiful Baylis on Biaggi on Rossi at one point. And it was fascinating because that old thing of, and I've been told this on driving courses, on the off-road, on the BMWs with Cy Pavey, you know, you go, and on track day instruction, you know, look where you want to go because you tend to go there. And we've heard this before about people getting sucked in. If the guy you're following goes wide, you tend to go wide with him. And Lorenzo and Rossi came down. I think this was one of the ones where Rossi was on the inside because he tried the inside and the outside. And Lorenzo kind of just let him go, in very much like Baylis to Biaggi. Yeah, you cannot stop. So here's the door. please help yourself. If you'd like to go out onto the veranda whilst I take the corner. He did that, but behind Rossi, we had Dovi, Marquez, Iannone, Pedrosa. They kind of all just got sucked into where Rossi had gone, not where Lorenzo had gone, which brought him a bit of breathing space, but very quickly they were back. Also on the first lap, we lost Miller, Bautista and Baz.
Yes.
In a kind of mass crash.
Yes, Alvaro Bautista was back to his bowling ball best and managed to take out both Miller and Baz. Baz broke four bones in his right foot and is undergoing surgery on Wednesday to get the foot plated to hopefully be fit for the Catalan GP.
I saw Loris's tweet about it, and he actually sounded quite cheerful, which I found strange. He was like, I've broken four metatarsals in one foot and one in the other, or metacarpal in my hand, or whatever. Yeah, and he seemed quite happy.
Which, you know, you've just got to smile, is what they say, right? When life gives you a broken foot, make a robot foot, because there are going to be a few plates in that foot. But anyway, we had Lorenzo and Rossi out at the front. Lorenzo seemed to be in control for most of the race, but Rossi was poking up there on occasion, you know, making sure that Lorenzo knew he was right there. All the while, Alicia Spargo had made a great start, but he dropped down, and Marc Marquez was quite quickly catching Lorenzo and Rossi. It seemed like Lorenzo was having to take slightly different lines just to make sure Rossi didn't get through.
Marquez was interesting, I thought. It looked like he absolutely busted a gut to get up to them, but there just wasn't enough left to get past, but they couldn't lose him.
Yeah.
He was always there, third of a second behind Rossi, not really close enough to be, you know, showing Rossi the wheel, but at the same time, not being lost.
Yeah,
at all.
I think it could have been a really, really incredible end to the race with those three battling, had it not been for Rossi's engine. It looks like Rossi was building up to pass Lorenzo, and then suddenly the number 46 just started dropping down the standings, and then they cut to it. Valentino Rossi head on tank with smoke pouring out the back of his Yamaha M1, just like Jorge Lorenzo. He'd had an engine blow up. Very peculiar to see two engines blow up on the same weekend. Even more peculiar to see two Yamaha engines blow up on the same weekend. Obviously, Ducati in the past have had one or two reliability issues, but, you know, Yamaha really have that reputation for being one of the more reliable motorcycles in MotoGP.
Yeah.
But both Lorenzo and Rossi had engine problems. That was obviously Rossi's race over, and a huge disappointment for all the fans at Mugello. There were definitely one or two shots of a couple of people leaving the racetrack early.
Okay, they're Rossi fans, I understand that. I don't, you know, personally, I'm there for the racing, but I get that. And interesting, on the same lap, we lost Scott Redding, who had been up to sixth, seventh at one point. Mm. And Scott Redding just pulled in with another technical failure, you know, which leads us back to the email we had at the beginning of the show from James. James Duet, or Duet. Please write in, James, and let us know how we need to say your name, because I don't want to get someone's name wrong. It's poor form. But yeah, poor old Scott Redding pulled in. But then Marquez just set about Lorenzo, and Iannone set about everyone behind them. He could never quite close the gap to them, but he was just brilliant.
Yeah, Iannone was great to watch. It was him, Dovizioso, and Pedrosa battling for a fair few laps. As we said, Dovi made a bit of a mistake. And then Iannone and Pedrosa, they had quite a good little battle, changing positions a couple of times. Iannone would eventually get the better of Danny Pedrosa, just out dragging him to the line. But the real highlight of the race came in the final three laps. Marc Marquez had been stalking Jorge Lorenzo, stalking him. And then the new Marc Marquez, the conservative one, the one who's happy to pick up 20 championship points, he left Mugello, and the old Marquez came back. And
he went down the pub.
Yep, and all Marquez wanted to do was beat Jorge Lorenzo. And those final three laps were absolutely incredible. Marc Marquez's Honda was making all sorts of just disgusting shapes into San Donato as he tried everything he could to try and pass Jorge Lorenzo on the brakes. But as we'd seen throughout the entire race, Jorge Lorenzo was just unstoppable into turn one.
Yeah, and he also, I mean, I think he said with a little bit of spikiness after the race, "See, I can fight." Now, I don't know where this idea came from. That, you know, people said it about Danny Pedrosa, people said it about Bradley Smith in 125s, in fact, Julian Simon, who beat him to the championship that Bradley was closest to winning. You know, yeah, if I go past Bradley, I don't see him again. Lorenzo's never been like that. He can mix it, but as he says himself, if he can get out front and not be interfered with, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, he's there to win races, and he mixed it with Marquez, but I mean, that final lap as they came into the penultimate big turn before the chicanes that lead you down where Rossi broke his leg, that lead you down to the final turn.
Yeah, the Biondetti chicane.
Lorenzo got past Marquez at that, the last sweeper, and I can't remember its name, sorry, it's something Italian. And then Marquez just sort of, with his bike almost sideways, in a Yoni Hernandez kind of step the back out, elbowed his way past. It really looked like he was, you know, in a hurry to get his pizza delivery, elbowing through the queue at the fast food outlet.
Yeah, and it just seemed like a crash was coming as well. Like, both those guys had gotten so, so close. And, you know, there was a bit of touching. I think that at one point, one of their elbow sliders actually came off down the straight because, you know, they were that close. And then, yeah, in that final corner, Marc Marquez was just ahead, and I was almost certain that either he was going to lose it or Jorge Lorenzo's front wheel was just going to touch his and it was all going to end in disaster. But what followed was, yeah, easily the last the most dramatic lap in
of the season. Julian Ryan and Keith Ewan said, well, that's it, Marquez has won it as he came around the corner. Because the point they were saying is with a MotoGP bike, the toe is not powerful enough to get you in front to the line, because the line is only, you know, halfway up the straight. It's not right near the end. And they were proved wrong.
Yes.
Because Lorenzo outdragged Marquez and won by 0.019 of a second.
Yes.
Seventh closest ever finish in the Premier class.
Yes, and it's the closest finish since Casey Stoner and Ben Spies at Valencia 2011, I believe. When Casey Stoner said that the final lap of that race was the hardest he'd had to ride all year. And that was obviously the year that Stoner won the title for Honda. So pretty good race. But to me, that drag to the line really highlighted the issue Honda has with getting the power down. You know, I don't think that anyone who's been listening to MotoPod or anyone who's a big MotoGP fan would expect a Yamaha to beat a Honda in a straight line battle. Even with the slipstream, you know, you wouldn't really suggest...
Not until recent years.
Yeah.
But the last year or two...
Yeah, and you know,
Yamaha slowly got better, but Honda dramatically got worse.
Yeah, so you saw Marc Marquez have a slight wheelie about halfway between the final corner and the finish line. And it was that slight wheelie that basically killed his chance of the win and that allowed Jorge Lorenzo, who was able to keep both his wheels on the ground, throughout that entire drag. And one of the funniest parts of the weekend was Marc Marquez's pit crew. They were under the same impression as Julian Ryder and Keith Ewan, that they thought Marquez had won. And then the camera was panning across them and you just saw them go from elation to devastation as they suddenly realised that, oh no, Jorge's gotten ahead.
Yeah. And it's fascinating because if he had won, they would now be on equal points, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they would have been.
But they're not. They're 10 points apart. Lorenzo is on 115. Marquez 10 behind on 105. Rossi significantly behind now on 78. With Danny Pedrosa only 12 points behind him on 66. With Vinales 6 points behind him on 59. 10 points ahead of his teammate Aleix Espargaró on 49. So on and so forth. All the way down to Jack Miller, who is bottom of the pile with 2 points.
Yes, it's going to be an uphill battle for Valentino Rossi to win this championship now. Two DNFs is huge. Rossi has won the title with two DNFs before. I think it was in 2004, I think it was, when he beat Biaggi and Gibernau.
That was the first year on the Yamaha. Did he DNF twice that year?
Yes, I was looking at the stat. Yeah. It was either 2004 or 2003, obviously either with Yamaha or Honda there. But with riders like Marquez and like Lorenzo and, you know, also like Iannone and like Danny Pedrosa, Rossi needs to go on some sort of winning streak and try and get back those points because, as you say, he is a significant margin behind Jorge Lorenzo. And we've seen how competitive MotoGP is. And I think that this, I don't know. It's a shame to rule him out so early, but it's going to take more problems for Marquez and for Lorenzo.
Yeah. Highest place, Ducati. Eighth place, Hector Barbera. 2 points ahead of Iannone. In fact, there's a whole bunch of Ducatis together. It's Barbera, Iannone, Laverty, and Dovizioso, all within 9 points of each other.
Yeah, I think that certainly Iannone will surpass Hector Barbera. Barbera was complaining all weekend that they've reached the limitation of that bike, is that now they can tell it's 2 years old, and, you know, the factory bikes are still taking steps forward, but he and the Aventia Racing team are, you know, trying to make the best of a bad situation now, and Barbera not quite as confident as he was at the start of the year.
It's probably talking about race wins. Oh, can you hear that cat in the background?
Yes, we can. He's
being very talkative. Bless him. Sharon found him a couple of weeks ago, basically lying, dying, very, very jaundiced and anemic. So we've had him to the vets, and he's much better, as you can hear.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've had a three-host Motopod show, so good to bring that tradition back.
Frankie, do us a favour, mate. Shut the fuck up. I don't know how you say that in Arabic. The answer to the question we said earlier, the last non-alien, so not Rossi, Lorenzo, Marquez, Pedrosa or Stoner to win a race, was Ben Spies, Assen, 2011. He's been mentioned a few times recently. Yeah, and that was the one where I think Bautista had wiped out Lorenzo. Or was it Simoncelli?
It was Simoncelli that year.
Knocked off Lorenzo. There's some funny stuff going on. But 5 years since had a non-alien.
Long, long and time.
Very quickly on, and we will make this brief.
Yeah, as we said, neither of us have seen these races or the qualifying. But BSB, it was at Brands Hatch Indy. So, you know, lap times were...
Brands Hatch shit track, as we like to think of it.
Yes, comically short lap times, 45 seconds lap, basically. Luke Mossi took pole ahead of James Ellison, Shane Byrne, Michael Laverty, Richard Cooper, and Tommy Bridwell, rounding out the top six, with Haslam beating out Hopkins and Jason O'Halloran, and then Peter Hickman rounding out the top 10. That was qualifying. Obviously, in BSB, qualifying is only good for the first race. So there was that. Leon Haslam managed to win the first race.
He mugged James Ellison on the last corner, apparently.
Yes, 0.057 separated the two teammates.
Huge gap after what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually almost double the gap in the MotoGP race. So, you know, that race must have been absolutely boring. But yeah, Ellison was quite upset to finish second. Obviously, getting beaten by that much is always tough to swallow. Tommy
and
Bridwell.
Your teammate.
Yes, exactly. Teammate always makes it worse. Tommy Bridwell, surprisingly enough, was third on the Bennett Suzuki. Obviously, Suzuki have not had the best time. Speaking of Bennett Suzuki, Ryuichi Kiyonari broke his collarbone, so his season continues to get worse and worse and worse, and it's not yet sure what time Kiyonari will be back. I can't imagine he'll be rushing back, though.
No. Several DNFs, and race two got away. Shane Byrne managed to win this one. Richard Cooper came second. Leon Haslam came third, so a double podium for Leon. Tommy Bridwell was fourth. Dan Linfoot fifth. Jason O'Halloran, Christian Eden, Peter Hickman, Stuart Easton, Luke Mossi, John Hopkins, Lee Jackson, Harry Mannering, Smart, Alistair Seely, and Danny Buck, and this cat's getting on my nerves, rounding out the points, which means Leon is leading on 93 points. Shane Byrne only 3 points behind on 90. Christian Eden only 4 points behind that on 86. And that's with no wins. So consistency showing there for the former Supermoto champion, Christian Eden. Richard Cooper, fourth. Michael Laverty, fifth. James Ellison down is seventh. That's strange.
Yep, and James Ellison therefore not making the showdown if it were to finish as it is now, because Jason O'Halloran is sixth, and only the top six get the extra special 500 points for being the specialist little kids in BSB.
Yeah, but we're only three rounds in with, I think, 11 to go, something like that. A lot, anyway.
Yes, still a long way. Then
in stock six,
Jordan Weaving got his career first pole position and then went on to finish second in the race. So good result there, for Dave Ryder.
And ahead of Sam Thompson. So good for Jordan. I'm sure Dave was over the moon with that. And he's fourth in the standings, although he's actually joint third with Bradley Jones on the same points.
Good result there for Jordan.
Stock fouls. Niall McKenzie's son, Taylor, got pole. Josh Elliott, Dave's other lad, was third. So front row start. And in the race, he also finished. In fact, they finished. It was McKenzie, Olsen, Elliott, and Ian Hutchinson of TT fame were they're all on BMWs. That was the front four. And the race finished. McKenzie, Hutchinson, and Elliot, first, second, and third. Ian Hutchinson, great, great to see Hutchie doing so well. Michael Rutter, the old warhorse, was fourth, and Alex Olsen, who'd start in the front row, was fifth.
Yep. So, and if you get the chance, go to Taylor McKenzie's Twitter, because here's a video clip of his start to the Stock 1000 race, which is one of the best race starts I've ever seen. He absolutely shot off the line and was, you know, already a second ahead by turn one, it seemed like.
Must have been waiting to see the board come out saying ride through penalty for jump start.
Possibly.
MCM Fantasy League, they have actually updated. We are, I believe, up to date now. Leading the way is Sid Sandbaggers by Tom Sid, 1,064 points. Only 4 points behind is Giulio Lupatelli with Thyrus Racing on 1,060. And Craig Lowe, who's been up there, Craig, friend of Dave's and friend of the show, the Cockney Liverpool fan, Shothole Racing, he's on 1,031. So dropping back a bit. Worth noting, Tom Sid is only 27th in the overall competition. So go on, my son. I'm still leading the host. I'm 42nd overall with 1,004 points. Harry, you're 87th with 807. Scott is 90.
That's a big gap. I'm not sure how you've managed that. That's a very, very big gap.
By creative transfers. All within the rules. Oh, this cat. What's wrong with you? He wants some food, but we have to put his medicine in the food, so we have to make him hungry.
It is
distraction.
A cat.
Yeah, it's a bit annoying. Come here. Come and have a stroke. You skanky, manky thing. He's got the biggest dangly pair of bollocks you've ever seen as well, but we can't get the vets to whip him off until he's better.
Some lovely extra details there.
Yeah. So, Harry, you're 87th with 807. You're second in the host, Necessary Fast, with your team. Scott Boltman, Team Mojo Dog, is 92nd with 790. Dave, dropping away, 707. He's 83 points behind Scott, 115th place with Dipper Racing. And Len, who has freely admitted he hasn't even looked at his team since the season started, 179th with 407 points with Moto Lento. Race is coming up. We've got on the Donington Park World Superbike coming up this weekend.
Yes.
Weekend after is Catalunya MotoGP. More news about that coming up probably next week. We haven't got any more British Superbikes till the end of June. Knock Hill. And we haven't got any more, 2 weeks' time, we've got, 10 days' time, we've got Road America in Wisconsin is Moto America's next showing.
Yes, and then we obviously have the TT coming up. I believe it starts this Saturday, which is why there's such a big gap in the BSB schedule, obviously, because all of those teams and riders do both. And, you know, as we said, with the...
You just said doo-doo.
Yes, I did just say doo-doo. The TT, always interesting to watch. Of course, we will bring you updates from that once it does get underway. Looking forward to Donington Park World Superbike. Should be very interesting. Pretty jam-packed schedule these next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
With Donington, then with Catalunya and all those stuff. So definitely a lot to talk about in the shows coming up. And I think that's pretty much it for this weekend, unless Martin's cat has anything more to add.
Yeah, I'm sure he has, but I don't think we should give him any more airtime. It just encourages him.
Okay. Well, with that, it's bye from me, and we'll catch everybody next week.
And it's goodbye from him. Good night.
Ciao.